Counsel, for the next case, Sharma versus Garland, 22-1496. Can take the tables, please. Our next case this morning is Sunil Kumar Sharma versus Merrick B. Garland, case number 22-1496. Counsel for the petitioner, please take the podium and put your appearance on the record.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Pablo Lozano. I'm a clinical student in the Harvard Immigration Clinic under the supervision of Philip Torrey. I represent the petitioner, Sunil Sharma. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, you may.
The sole issue on review in the instant matter is whether Mr. Sharma automatically derived U.S. citizenship upon meeting the requirements established in the derivative statute. Section 1432A5 presents two disjunctive clauses for a minor to derive citizenship from a naturalized parent, either by residing in the United States pursuant to a lawful admission for permanent residence at the time of the naturalization of the parents, or when the child thereafter begins to reside permanently in the United States while under the age of 18 years. The disagreement today is centered on the second clause of Section 1432A5. I will first discuss the plain text of the statute, which clearly establishes two pathways to derivative citizenship. And second, I will explain why the objective manifestation test is used to determine whether an individual resides permanently under the second pathway. First, the statute's plain text makes clear that Section 1432A5 unambiguously provides two distinct pathways for children of naturalized citizens to derive citizenship. The first pathway requires the minor to be lawfully admitted for permanent residence, and the second pathway states that a minor must begin to reside permanently. And the plain text makes clear that the second pathway does not require that the minor be lawfully admitted as a permanent resident. And this aligns with the court's decision in Thomas v. Lynch. Although the court did not affirmatively land on the issue presented here, it carefully parsed through the statute and recognized this plain text reading. In fact, two circuits, both the Ninth Circuit in Chenot v. Garland, an en banc decision, and the Second Circuit in Nazuzu v. Holder, in a decision that actually rejected the very BIA decision that the government's relying on here today, both agree with our plain text reading of the statute.
What, and under your reading, what was the objective manifestation?
Your Honor, the objective manifestation is determining when the petitioner has resided permanently. And in both Mazuzu and in Chenot, the objective manifestation was satisfied when the petitioner submitted an application for adjustment of status, which is consistent with the facts that Mr. Sharma has here today. He submitted a petition for adjustment of status on January 3rd, 1996.
To be precise, his mother initiated the proceeding, and didn't he then abandon it?
So, Your Honor, he did abandon his interview. However, abandonment is immaterial to the instant matter. And notably, Chenot, actually, the mother and son didn't appear to their interviews. But the court did not say that this was relevant to whether or not he had objectively manifested the intent to reside permanently. It was not how far in the process the petitioner got or whether or not permanent residence is actually adjudicated. It was the actual submission of the application for adjustment of status. And we have that same fact pattern today.
Counsel, your brief omitted a material fact, actually a number of material facts. You omitted to tell us that the agency had denied his application for permanent, or his mother's application on his behalf for lawful permanent resident status, and that thereafter he did nothing to challenge that. And then there are some additional facts which were in the record of decision, which are quite inconsistent with the notion that objectively he had manifested an intent to remain here permanently. So let's go back. Are you saying that under circumstances where the agency has determined that he abandoned the application, denied it, he did not thereafter take an appeal, that nonetheless the agency erred in deciding he had not met his burden of showing objectively permanent resident status?
So, Your Honor, our argument is that he met the adjustment manifestation test reside permanently upon the submission of the application for adjustment of status.
Regardless of what happened thereafter.
Regardless of what happens thereafter, that's correct.
Okay, and what is your authority for that?
So, Your Honor, this is consistent with Congress's intent to maintain and preserve a family unit. And the provision has two clauses. And the first pathway is, again, it provides derivative citizenship automatically for minors who already have lawful permanent residence. The second pathway is dealing with classes of minors that don't already have that status. So what this is doing is providing a situation in which that minor can objectively manifest his intent to reside permanently afterwards. And with the submission of the application, why that point of time matters is that you don't want to have a delay. The adjudication process could take years. It could take...
There was no delay on these facts. I understand that you're a law student. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
You were obligated in your brief to disclose to us this material fact about what happened, merely because your theory considered that fact to be irrelevant. The does not excuse you from that obligation. The decision you are appealing from directly mentioned that and relied on that as a ground for its decision. So just take this as a learning experience. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So help me with this. Suppose, if I'm understanding your argument, the moment his mother filed the application, you would say the manifestation of an intent objectively was made and complete. It would seem to therefore follow that suppose 3 days later when he found out his mother did that, he wrote and said, I don't want to be a United States citizen. Please withdraw my application. Under your theory, I think you would still say there's an objective manifestation of intent?
Your Honor, under the theory, in the plain text of the statute, he would have derived citizenship upon the submission of the adjustment of status. Whether his statement afterwards and the intent after that would be something he'd have to take up with a different proceeding. However, he automatically derives citizenship at that point that he is a minor. He's under the age, he's under the guidance and support of his mother and his sole surviving parent in the situation. So the idea behind it is to preserve that family unit, ensure that he's here and begins to reside permanently. That would be our reading, Your Honor.
And suppose the mother wrote and said she's withdrawing it.
Your Honor, still under the plain text of the statute, we would still argue that is upon the adjustment of that application that the citizenship is automatically derived. That application at that moment was still a bona fide application
But oftentimes when we have a discrete event that occurs and we're trying to determine its significance, we aren't limited to facts that existed as of the moment that act occurred. Subsequent acts may shed light on the significance that we attribute to that. And why wouldn't that be the case here, that the subsequent abandonment sheds light on whether there was even a beginning?
Your Honor, I could see in a separate case, the totality of the circumstances being relevant to determining whether or not the manifestation was met. However, the court need not reach that issue here. Our petitioner did not withdraw his application. He submitted it. His intent was for it to be submitted. He never withdrew it. And our fact pattern still consistent with Cheneaux and Wazuzu, where it was the actual application itself that we're arguing is when he derived citizenship.
But don't we have a finding of a withdrawal, an abandonment, and a denial?
Your Honor, I'm arguing that abandonment is immaterial to the instant matter only because it's the actual submission and adjustment of status, not how far in the process he had received. The second clause notably does not mention lawful admission permanent residence as in the clause itself, in the definitions of permanent and residence within the statute. It does not require lawful admission permanent residence. Notably, other parts of the INA do mention lawful admission for personal for permanent residence as a requirement and a component part in addition to residing.
May I Going back to your statutory interpretation argument, you would have us read the statute to say that upon the submission by a parent of a lawful an application to establish LPR status, that conclusively determines that you then get the benefit of the second pathway. But the statute is not written that way. And even under your objective manifestation test, the statute isn't written that way.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the statute doesn't speak to that directly. The judgment manifestation is still consistent with the statute itself and Congress's intent to have an objective, administrable, and efficient bright-line test. So the objective manifestation.
Yes, and the test you're suggesting upon application by a parent for an LPR status is clear, and Congress chose not to do that.
So, Your Honor, is the question then why is it at that point that we're arguing that he automatically derived that citizenship?
I'm asking you to reconcile the fact that Congress knew very well how to adopt the test you are urging on us and chose not to do so.
Your Honor, Congress did not speak to it directly. It's not specifically within the statute itself, but it is still consistent with the statute. Notably, it's addressing the fact that Congress wanted an objective and efficient and administrable test, and it's providing that. It's not looking at a subjective intent and the mental state of the applicant. It's looking at a specific point in time in which a court could quickly analyze whether or not this individual has, in fact, begun to reside permanently. And that's what the test offers is a quick analysis in which two courts have thoroughly analyzed the plain text and legislative history of the statute, determined that this test meets that intent and is consistent with the statute.
You've spoken of objective manifestation. Some of the courts that you're relying on speak of official objective manifestation. And you say, is that the test? Is your test different than the official objective manifestation test?
No, Your Honor.
Same test.
The same test.
And so an application for LPR, in your view, does it, and you don't need to look at anything else after that. Is there some other way to officially, objectively manifest the intent that has been recognized?
When I recognize my time is when I may I finish the question?
Of course.
I don't know of all the options, but one option I could definitely think of, Your Honor, is that the minor enlists in the military under the age of 18 with consent of the mother at 17 and a half. I would argue that's still an objective manifestation at that point of enlistment, similar to the application. It was at the point of the submission of the application that he met the judgment manifestation. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. If lawful permanent resident status is the privilege of being allowed to live permanently in this country, as the INA defines it, then citizenship is the ultimate prize for those who are born in this country or who have naturalized by showing that they owe permanent allegiance to this country. In short, citizenship is not something that is easily attained. It's why even if a non-citizen marries a citizen, and gains LPR status, if they're still made to wait 3 years before having to file yet another application to gain citizenship. Now, 1432A5, yes, it does confer citizenship automatically. But that's all the more reason to make sure that a bright line rule can be applied. And in this case, under the rule that Mr. Sharma proposes, that would not be a bright line rule. That would actually invite a lot of chaos and a lot of ambiguity. And so it's our position that a rule that relies on status is a clear one and is a much more administrable one. Now,
you dispute, though, that the ambiguity problem here,
yes,
arises in the first instance with the text, mm-hmm, that we're called upon to construe. With the statute, it seems relatively impossible to completely parse it in a logical way on its own.
Sure. So, you know, we do acknowledge that the two phrases are different. If they were identical, we wouldn't be here. There wouldn't be this ambiguity. And so when they say that the two phrases are different, well, yes, we acknowledge that. But that's really assuming the conclusion that they want to reach. Now, the question is, how different are they?
Mr. Chen, you are familiar with R. Thomas' opinion.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In Thomas, Chief Judge Barron analyzed the statute, said, well, yes, it is ambiguous, but we don't need to decide in that case whether the agency's interpretation of the statute is correct, because even under the test which the petitioner is advancing, he simply fails. Why shouldn't we just adopt that model of decision here?
So that decision, I think they actually lay out why Mr. Sharma's preferred rule would not just be an unworkable one, but it would actually sort of let in a lot of bizarre kind of outcomes. If you look at Mr. Thomas's case, his mother had naturalized 3 days before his 18th birthday. Now, that's a very short period of time. He would have had to, you know, event some sort of official objective manifestation of intent. That's really hard to do in 3 days, I'd argue. Now, we would say that because he came here when he was very young, and because his mother had made several immigration filings, including an application for a voluntary departure that let him stay for 2 years, as well as an I-130, which is a precursor to an I-485, that he had actually made lots of official objective manifestations. But because they're asking for the statutory language to be read literally, all of that wouldn't have counted. What would have mattered is whether he had made some sort of official act during that three-day span. Because he didn't, he failed under his own test. Now, these are the kinds of outcomes that Mr. Sharma's preferred rule would invite, and we think a better one, or one that's much clearer, and one that's much more governable, is a rule that relies, that rises or falls on a person's status. Now, because I think opposing Mr. Lozano did say that this should be something that's quickly analyzed, and yes, we agree, it should be quickly analyzed, but if you rely on status as a sole sort of criterion, well, that's not something that can be quickly analyzed. That would actually be really difficult to show and to bear out. And so status really should be the be-all, end-all. And that might not seem somewhat harsh, but as seen in Mr. Thomas's case, Mr. Sharma's preferred ruling also invites some harsh consequences. Now, to return to the statutory language, again, yes.
If you know, I mean, how many cases are we talking about with respect to this repealed statute? What's the pipeline look like? What's the worry here?
I mean, the concern would be,
Judge Lynch has suggested we might do as we did in Thomas.
Right, right, right. So for folks who have turned 18 after 2000, after the 2000 Act, I mean, there the statutory language is very clear. There's no ambiguity there. So really we're talking about, I'd say, like the 50-year span between 52 and 2000. So that's 48 years. And, you know, there'd be a lot of cases in that 48 years. And under Mr. Sharma's, you know, more ambiguous rule, basically anyone who had filed an I-45 could derive citizenship. But, I mean, an I-485 application filing is not that hard to do. What's harder to do is to actually show up for the all-important interview, and not just that, but to be found admissible. Now, in this case, he was convicted of murder, and it's not entirely clear at this point whether that's a crime of moral turpitude, but we do know that if he had committed a crime of moral turpitude, he wouldn't be admissible even for adjustment of status. Now, he's saying that simply because I filed it, it doesn't really matter whether I was admissible or not. It doesn't really matter whether I actually followed through with the application, but we're saying, no, you do have to follow through with the application. I mean, and beyond that, you do have to have that official status, but at the very least, you should be showing up for your interview. And Mr. Lozano says that, no, all that matters is that he simply filed an application. But a person can file an application with fraudulent intent. And would these people be able to derive citizenship, which is the ultimate prize, as I mentioned earlier? We say not.
The question of how we deal with ambiguous text. It's a bit unusual that we don't have the usual agency interprets a statute, and we then just take ordinary review. Here we've got a statute where we undertake de novo review of the legal questions, and even the factual questions would not be decided by an agency. They would be decided by a district court. So is there any Chevron deference here in this case? You argue that there is in your brief, but what's your authority for saying that we would have to defer to the agency's decision?
So there is a circuit split on whether Chevron deference is owed in this sort of situation. But I think the argument would be that the board has issued a definitive finding as to this issue, as to which rule should dominate. And it's a clear ruling, and it's very reasonable. That's our argument. And on top of that, yes, this statutory language is ambiguous, and that's why the board had to come out with its ruling matter of Chenow and actually pronounce its position on this issue. And we think, you know, deference is over there. But really, our case, we're not putting all of our argument on the Chevron deference point. We think that deference is owed, but even if the court were to review this de novo, we think that the statutory language and the historical background more than bear out the rule that the government is advancing. Now, with regard to the statutory language, yes, you know, we do admit that it could have been written perhaps more concisely, more compactly, you know, along the lines of the 2000 Act. But the fact that it includes this pretty similar phrase, begins to reside permanently, shouldn't mean that it was that Congress was trying to institute a rule that would create some bizarre outcomes. And, you know, and I think the lexical argument and the historical argument are very much intertwined, because, you know, Mr. Sharma is saying that reside permanently can only be read generically, whereas lawful permanent residence is a term of art. And, you know, perhaps reside permanently can, yes, you know, at first glance be read generically, but if you actually look at the history of the residence decision law, you would understand that actually it was closer to a more formal term. I mean, you see this term in the 1907 Act, the 1940 Act, 1952, and 2000. So there's a common thread running through all of these acts. And the understanding is, and this is borne out not just by case law, but by authoritative treatises over the decades, the common understanding is that reside permanently means lawful permanent residence.
I'll take you back to Judge Lynch's question. Is one of your fallback arguments here that even if the petitioner's construction of the statute were correct, and even if he could satisfy it by an objective manifestation, as in Thomas, he fails to do so?
Sure. Even if the court were inclined to go with his preferred rule, we would say he fails under that rule, just like Thomas failed under.
And then my question is, how do we wrap Chenery into taking that approach, given that the no agency itself has adopted that alternative rationale?
Well, I think the court would say that it's undertaking de novo review, and that it finds that it can take basically the first an open inquiry into what the language actually means. And so if the court were to find that it should adopt the subjective manifestation rule, I believe it could definitely sort of lay out its argument for why the agency should abide by it. If the court were to issue its ruling, I think the agency would be bound to it to a large degree.
We only get to petitioner's argument under your view if we don't find Chevron deference because this is de novo review. And if we haven't found Chevron deference because this is de novo review, then we would not face the impediment of Chenery in selecting an alternative grounds for deciding the case without deciding the statutory interpretation.
Well, that's a very pithy way to put it, yes, Your Honor. Now, to return to the history and this confusion between, you know,
counsel, I think we do understand your argument. We are often obliged under precedent and good judging not to reach to decide issues we don't have to decide. And as Judge Howard has pointed out, this statute has been repealed, and It may yet occur that a case will come up which requires us to flatly look at the issue of two issues, whether the agency's interpretation is correct and whether any form of deference is due to it. But as I've suggested, it seems to me that even under his test, the abandonment of the LPR petition by not showing up at the interview would tend to fail that test.
And yes,
isn't that a kind of narrower ruling?
That is correct, Your Honor. I think this case is quite close to Thomas, and if anything, it might actually be easier to rule on this case than Thomas without actually straying into this question of, you know, what's a more reasonable interpretation of the statute. I mean, in Mr. Sharma's case, I understand he was very young and he might have been a callow youth, but not all callow youths are committing murder out there. And in his case, it's not just the murder fact, it's the fact that he failed to show up for the all-important vital interview for his I-485 application. And I understand there were intervening circumstances, but those circumstances were all of his own making. I mean, he said himself, I was in trouble with the law. At the very least, you should understand that you do not have status in this country, and you should try your best not to commit any major crimes, even petty crimes. And yet he flagrantly failed to do that. And so our argument would be that, yes, under the kind of approach that, you know, the court adopted in Thomas, that he would fail under his own preferred rule, and said this petition should be denied.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just to return to Judge Kayada's question, based on what you just said.
Yes.
So Chenery is not a problem in that circumstance because we can hypothetically say? Yeah. I mean, how does that work?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, just as Chenery wasn't really a problem in Thomas, I don't think it would be a problem here if the court were to find that, you know, under either interpretation, he still fails. He can't prevail on his claim that he is a derived citizen. If there are no other questions, we will rest on the brief that we've submitted. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Kim.
Your Honor, 2 points on rebuttal. First, two other courts have found that there are two pathways to derivative citizenship in the statute, both Cheneaux and Mazzuzu in the Ninth Circuit en banc decision and the Second Circuit's decision. And second, if there are any questions as to the underlying facts, we should transfer to a district court. Unless there are further questions, we respectfully ask the court grant the petition, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lozano.